We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man.
All right, hey-ho, and here we go. It is a We Talk Comics interview special. I am your co-host, Keith. I am joined by Brett. Say hi, Brett.
Hello, Brett. Oh, I do that all the time. I should stop.
And also Chris is here. Say hi, Chris.
Hi, my toes are curling. It's been a while since we've done a podcast. Those live ones really put us back on the schedule.
Yeah, we've been running a lot of panels from Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. We've had a couple interview specials. We had the food podcast that really should have held. We should have held that one until April because there's 3 hours with literally no comic talk in it. But this is an interview special. We are joined at long last. This is a guest I have wanted on the show from the very beginning, Dan Juergens.
Hey, glad to be here.
Just Dan Juergens. You're not going to say comic book legend Dan Juergens.
I think if anybody warrants comic book legend, it's Dan Juergens.
I'm flattered, but certainly not necessary.
I had a longer preamble, but I left it at the office. I left all of my notes, so just I'm winging it. Now, longtime listeners of the show will know that me mentioning Booster Gold can literally be used as a drinking game when you're listening. So, the creator of Booster Gold, Dan Juergens, the man who killed Superman, Dan Juergens, and comic book legend, Dan Juergens.
what else? Part of the drinking game? Can we start?
Absolutely, go nuts. By the time you're done, you will be incoherent. He'll mention Booster Gold so much.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to start now with Booster Gold.
Excellent.
You, yes. You have the DC...
Let's start with Batmite, because that's an important book, man.
Absolutely, let's start with Batmite. Last month, we got the 8-page previews of two books that you're writing for the new DC relaunch. And Batmite is 6-issue miniseries, right, Dan?
Right.
And This is one of your first forays into comedy.
It is in a way. I mean, obviously, I touched on comedy a little bit with Booster Gold and a couple other things here and there. But Batmite is the first one where that is absolutely sort of the target point on the series, no doubt.
Now, I absolutely love Batmite, but that could be just because I grew up with the new adventures of Batman, which Batmite was a central character. But Batmite has had one shot in 30 years. Did you pitch doing this series, or Did somebody come to you and say,
no,
Batmite, we want you here?
It actually, like many things, and I think a lot of guys have stories like this. When it comes to creation, when it comes to ideas, it is, I think, best when it's not a linear process. You have thoughts, you have ideas, they kind of weave all over the place. And I had been talking with Dan DiDio a little bit about various things and themes that I wanted to explore. And I knew I was going to be coming off Future's End, which was a real intensive writing exercise. Part of that is when you're working that tightly with three other writers. And on Future's End, we had Brian Azzarello, Jeff Lemire, and Keith Giffen, and we got along great, but it's really, from a writer's standpoint, it's an intense exercise. So I knew I was going to be coming off that, and I just wanted to do something different. And I was talking to Dan about ideas and themes that I wanted to explore, and the idea of doing something funny that could be somewhat satirical, where we could make backdoor comments a little bit about human nature, society, things like that. But I never had the vehicle. I didn't have the character. We just talked about themes and ideas. And then he said, well, keep working on it. Keep working at it. And I'm interested. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I just thought, well, geez, what about Batmite? So I just said to Dan, basically that. I just said, you know that idea we've been talking about? What if it was Batmite? And Dan said, you know, I wouldn't say no. And that was it. We were off and running.
And so we've seen the first issue's out. We've seen a couple of heroes so far. Who else can we expect to see in this run?
Coming up in issue 2, which should be out in about 2 weeks, we get a little more Hawkman. After that, we have a fun issue with Robin. That would be issue 3. Issue 4 is going to be some guy by the name of Booster Gold. You might have heard of him. And then number 5 is the Inferior 5.
Oh, fantastic.
Now, I may be venturing into spoiler territory. If you can't tell us, that's fine. But does Booster have a Mite counterpart? And what would he be called, if you can tell us?
Well, the concept of where Batmite comes from and what counterparts might exist there and everything else, you're right, that's getting into spoiler territory, but those are obviously some things we're going to be dealing with as the series unfolds.
I am very happy by that answer, actually.
Oh, good.
We're getting our first call. We are on a call-in show.
It's Dan DiDio. He heard his name was mentioned and he's calling in to say I forced Batmite on.
That would be exciting. I'd like to get him on too.
I've invited Dan on many occasions. Dan DiDio on many occasions. He still hasn't taken me up on it, but one day. Now, Dan, you said about you mentioned Future's End. And then you were one of the few creators who was working in the New 52 and worked on Convergence.
Right.
Now that we're on the other side of Convergence, Batmite is one of the new books that isn't continuity tied for the first time in almost 4 years.
Yeah.
So how do you decide what kind of version of these characters you're going to use if you're not restricted by what's being done elsewhere?
You know, I've always been of the mind that we needed to loosen up from the restrictive bounds of continuity a little bit. And, you know, if I go back to the 80s, people used to ask me, well, Dan, what do you think of what Keith Giffen is doing with Booster Gold in Justice League? I mean, do you like it? Do you hate it? Do you want to kill Giffen? What do you want to do? And my basic answer was always this, and that is I looked at the Justice League books as taking place on Earth Giffen. And it's not to say that they were contradictory to DC continuity or anything else, but they were firmly entrenched in a corner of the universe in which they had their own flavor. And I've always thought we should do more of that in comics, that there is a way to have a couple of different types of Superman stories there are a couple of different ways to portray the DCU. And I think if the success of the Harley Quinn book did anything, it was to say, we can have a Harley Quinn in the DCU that appears totally differently in a couple of different series, right? And especially since Harley Quinn as a title became something of a hit. And I think what that allows me to do is to pull Robin into Batmite, to pull Batman into Batmite, and let people think that, gee whiz, I'm reading this story where the internal logic is consistent. And if I just do a little bit of a leap and a jump, then yeah, it's going to be consistent with the rest of the DCU as well. And I think that's how we're playing it.
That's interesting, yeah, because you don't have the Bat Bunny. You don't have the robot Batman.
No, we don't. And, I think we could say, we talked about this, as a matter of fact, from an editorial standpoint, is should we add one of those boxes that said, the events in Batmite number one take place before the events of Batman number 41, something like that. And obviously there was a time and a place where we would have done that. We don't need that anymore. I think it's good that we don't need that anymore, because what we're really starting to see is that as concepts, that these characters can be somewhat elastic. And I think that's really a good thing.
A little robot bunny Batmite might be very cute, though.
Yeah, it actually would be at that.
Well, and is it not saying something about readership nowadays that you can kind of get away with that and not have to spell it out for them completely?
It is. I was talking with a fellow writer just today, and this is one of the things we were talking about, is it wasn't that long ago when it was almost like the goal was to get everybody to buy every book in the line. So if you did a crossover, if you did your big Frozen in Hell crossover, the idea was to get everybody would buy the main series. 90% of the people would buy the Justice League book that tied in. 80% would buy Superman. 85% buy Batman. Stuff like that. The idea was get everybody on board. And I think one of the refreshing things about the business now, and especially what DC embraced for June, was the idea that, it's okay to have a group of people buying this book. They might buy Harley Quinn and they might buy Starfire, but maybe Superman isn't their thing, and that's okay. And it's this idea that we can have a more diverse line. And when I use the word diverse, it is to say diversity of concept and idea. I think as an industry, we sort of got caught up in diversity as it relates to ethnic background, skin color, gender, whatever. And really, I think, to me, what I found so interesting is that what we're seeing in June is diversity of ideas and diversity of concept and diversity approach. And the fact that it's done by a very diverse workforce is a great thing. But really, the success of it all is different ideas and different comic books told with a different approach. And I think that's great.
Yeah, that's something I wrote about at Comicosity, actually, when the first issues were coming out, is that in all the talk of diversity of all of those things, one of the things that I never saw mentioned was Batmite and Bizarro are rated E,
right.
Which hasn't happened. It hadn't happened in the New 52 ever. There hadn't been an E book.
And it's
that diversity of age group.
It is. I don't know that. Because, that's something we talked about. And I wondered, well, does that represent something of a risk? Because if you look at movies as a standpoint, the G label used to be a killer. So people went for PG or whatever. And then, they try and do sort of a soft R to get an older audience and everything. And, we did have that as something of a concern. But at the same time, we said, let's try it. Let's see what happens. Let's try and do a book that can be interpreted that way. And to a certain extent, if you go back to Saturday Morning and the old, Pee-wee's Playhouse type idea, there were jokes there and story approaches and everything that kids absolutely loved. But if you were the adult in the room watching it with your 7-year-old, there were jokes that would float by and you just go into, whoa, did I hear what I thought I heard? And, as a show, they were making an effort to speak to multiple audiences and age groups with that. And so we can try and do a little bit of that with Batmite.
So now you're not doing the art on either of the books. Was there a desire by you to do the art, or was this just kind of, I want to write and focus on that?
No, it's this goes back to kind of as we were getting Future's End off the ground, which was a weekly. I was supposed to be one of the regular artists on it. And the fact that it was a weekly meant it took more time writing it than we thought it would, and that was fine. But we really kind of got Future's End up and running. I think I drew issue 3. And then all of a sudden, we had all those September 5-year-later books coming out. And for that, you know, I wrote Booster Gold, Superman, Aquaman, and Aquaman and the others. So what was really happening is my time was getting so taken up by writing that I never had the ability to swing over to draw anything. And then even as we were starting to look at the end of Future's End, and I'd say, gee, you know, I've got to find a way to draw something here. All of a sudden, Convergence came up, and we started planning for that. And so as we've been kind of world-building our way through Future's End, leading into Convergence and everything else, there has just never been the time for me to clear everything off the board and get back to drawing regularly. I still want to do it. It's just a matter of getting everything to the right point where I can.
No, we've talked about.
Just one quick question, Chris. What was the lead time on Convergence? When was the work of that project done? Because we all know kind of why it was done.
Oh wow, it's a good question. Let me think. You know, we started planning it probably like in March or April of 2014, and something like that. I mean, it takes a long time to really start to pull the idea together of what all those books were going to be. And in fact, one of the ways we first tried it was we were writing down all these concepts and everything, and what would the different worlds be? And that then became what would the different cities be? And what was the internal logic behind the way it was all going to work? And because we just had everything on the board. And I think quite honestly, at one point, we were looking at it and saying, oh my God, we've got like 60 different books on the board. So we had to start winnow it down. Actual real production probably started in September of last year, I would say. For me, it was easier just because I had been sort of in the planning stages from the beginning. Whereas at that point, we were just starting to bring in writers to explain the concept to them and say, and here's what you can do with it. And if you want to do, you know, the Freedom Fighters, and they're located in this city, and it's this time frame, here's how it'll work. So, you know, really, it was probably by September of last year that we were up and running.
Interesting. Chris, you were gonna.
Yeah. Well, you've been on for Future's End. You were immersed in Convergence. Now, you're off on your own. I mean, I know writing a book with the talented people you were on with Future's End, that has an excitement to it. Is it almost a relief when you can just do what you want rather than writing in sort of a conference?
That, like many things in life, sort of has a yes and a no answer to it. I mean, if I go back to when I was working on Superman, and we had 3 other writers, and we were all... And
very solid rookie season.
Hold on, guys. Something's out of control here.
I'm glad we're not the only ones who have trouble like that.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what that was.
I think
Dan's
anyway, secret project is...
yeah, not
the secret project is watching Netflix. We're doing
yeah, no, that was a baseball game, and somehow the audio just kicked up to a ridiculous extent. Anyway, when I was back working on the Superman books, there is sort of a sense of enthusiasm that builds up when you're working with other writers, because you are telling stories in a format that you can't possibly tell any other way. That in essence, Superman was a weekly comic book at times for us. And there was just no other way that we could have told those stories other than to make it a weekly comic book. And so the same thing is true on Future's End, where, yes, it can be frustrating because your hands are somewhat tied. But at the same time, I always felt we had a big story to tell. And working with guys whose work I respected as much as I do those three, I think we were really able to tell a story in a way that only could have been told as a weekly.
And how did you break up the writing? Did you write one character? Did you write kind of, how did you trade that stuff off?
We each had a group of five or six characters that we really focused on. So, you know, in the beginning, for example, all the masked Superman stuff was pretty much me. The Firestorm stuff, Madison Payne, Tim Drake, and all of that was pretty much me. Brian Azzarello started out with Batman Beyond and the future stuff and that sort of thing as he came back. Keith Giffen was doing 50 Sue. Jeff Lemire was handling Frankenstein. And then as we worked through the series, we would have our characters cross over for a little bit. So, for example, I think it was Jeff that first started out with Lois. Then I took Lois and pulled her into the Masked Superman storyline. And then later ended up handing her off again. Whereas at the same time, Brian Azzarello was telling Constantine's story. So he brought Kal-El into the book. And once we finally found where Kal-El was, and that's just so we can differentiate everything, I took him on. I took Lois back. So I was handling Superman and Lois. At that point, Shazam sort of stepped aside. But that's basically how it worked. We essentially had our own crew, and around that time I handed Tim Drake off to Brian. So we planned it that way, but everybody pretty much wrote their own small cast of characters.
So then was it always going to be your job to write Batman Beyond afterwards?
Not necessarily. We always knew that the idea was that the series was going to end with Terry dying and Tim becoming Batman Beyond. We said, if at that time somebody wants to take it up and run with it as a series, the potential is there. But we probably really didn't decide to do that, you know, until we were somewhere around issue 40. You know, it was fairly late in the run that became more of a decision.
How about the adding of Bernard Chang on the art? Because his work on the series is fabulous.
It is. I think when I was talking with Bob Harris one day, and he said, okay, so Batman Beyond, who do you see drawing it? And the first guy I suggested was Bernard. I have always wanted to work with Bernard. We've known each other a long time, since back in our Acclaim days, actually. That's when we first met. And Bernard's background education is actually as an architect. And one of the things I was trying to tell people is I wanted a very firmly defined visual world that is will exist 35 years from now. If you look at the Batman Beyond animated cartoon, you know, Gotham City is almost a little bit Legion of Superheroes like. Looks like it's, you know, 500 years in the future, not 35. And that's cool. That's part of the fun. But Bernard has a very stylized sensibility to his work. And I thought, you know, he would be perfect for Batman as a figure. I could just, because of the way he constructs a figure, I thought he would be very good at kind of this more life figure that is Batman Beyond. And more than anything, his sense of storytelling and sense of style would really help create a book that looked like it was taking place in a different time and space with its own visual language. And that's exactly what he's done.
Now, were you at all concerned launching a Batman Beyond book with a different protagonist? Sure, the free 8-page issue gives the big surprise, or gives the information that this is Tim Drake and not the original. But you also have a huge following of the cartoon that haven't necessarily read Future's End. Right. Was that a concern?
very much. And so the idea is, how do you handle that? And it's something I was very aware of. I think if you read the 8-page story, I don't think we mentioned Brother Eye in it once. You see sort of the dragon type creature, but I don't think we ever mentioned Brother Eye's name. We don't talk about any of the characters that were also in Future's End that are around in that future. It really is a Batman Beyond story. And I know Terry has his fans, but I also think this. I think of the book in a way as a triangle. And on the one hand, at one point of the triangle, we have Tim Drake, who represents the current present of the DC universe. At the other point of the triangle, we have the Batman Beyond animated world that everybody knows. And at the third point of the triangle, we have sort of the DCU Great Disaster future storyline with Commandy and everything like that. And what we're trying to do is we're taking those three elements, building them the triangle, and then the story is everything that takes place in between. I have always thought Tim Drake is a great character in and of its own right. I think some of that has not come across as strong as it could have in the New 52. Our job is to do that, to make him a cool character, but also make sure that we have the other elements of the Batman Beyond show in there. And that's why you've seen Terry's younger brother, Matt. You've seen Barbara Gordon. You've seen Max Gibson. We have other surprises coming up as well. And I keep, you know, telling Dan how we have all these elements, but this is how it's going to come together. And I think if people hang with us, they're going to be richly rewarded.
Well, there's one element I would love to see, just putting it out there.
Oh, Hex. God, Booster.
Hex. No, I want Hex. I want the Stuck in the Future Hex. No one's using them right now.
That's true. But there could be a reason for that.
Well, Dan, you opened the door a little bit there, and I'd like to talk about your run on Solar with Acclaim, because one of our other co-hosts, Mo and I, we went through and read every single Valiant book, and that seems insane, and I think it was, but when it came up, we were very excited about your Solar run, and it almost seems very odd within the context of Solar. And so I'd love to get your opinion on just what went down, how that all worked.
Sure. Do you have anything more specific, or are you just asking in general? How do you mean?
Well, just basically, because it was part of the Birthquake. And right. So what was Valiant like around that time that led to Birthquake? Because it struck me that the sales were kind of in free fall at that point, and that would be something to bring it up.
Sure. What had happened is Valiant had started out at that point, up till around that time, as its own independent publishing company. It was acquired by Acclaim, which was a video game company, which had at that time a huge hit of a video game, which I believe was NBA Jam. And they bought Valiant primarily as a source of ideas and properties for video games. And at the same time, they were putting a bunch of cash into the company to say, we wanted to create a bigger market presence. So they brought a bunch of us in as part of the Birthquake event. And I remember myself, you know, Ron Mars, some of the other guys who were working on everything, getting together in New York, and they were telling us, and we're just not going to release Solar monthly. We're going to release it twice a month. We're going to release XO twice a month. Everybody's going to go out twice a month. And we just kind of sat there and said, why? And they said, basically, well, it's because they put out 4 Superman titles a month and 4 Spider-Man titles a month, and they all sell. And we did say, they sell because they're Superman and Spider-Man, not because you get one every week. But that's what they wanted to go for. And it was an interesting idea. I think it made retailers actually be a little more cautious on their orders and how they approached it. But I would certainly say that I really enjoyed Solar as a character. I went out swinging and gave it my best shot. And unfortunately, when you take a company that has been a small company and all of a sudden try and make it a bigger company with bigger goals, they don't necessarily grow to that point in a natural way. It gets forced on them and things can fall apart in a hurry. And that's a bit of what happened.
Yeah, we had talked to Bob Layton about it because he was still editor-in-chief at that point, and he was definitely, right. He said that things were changing in such a way that, you know, a lot of the comics were being kind of forced out, you know, in just so the concepts could be put in its place.
Yeah.
Less story.
Yeah, there's truth to that. And I think the other part of it is, if you haven't worked in an environment where you're trying to produce a comic on a more than one per month basis, when you suddenly find yourself trying to do that, even if it's only, say, two issues of Solar a month, the deadlines and the way things rain down on you can become very, very oppressive. I knew what I was going into because I had done that kind of thing before. But from a company standpoint, I don't think they really realized what they were getting into in trying to keep creative teams together and those concepts coming out at that quick a pace.
So was it always designed for you to do the, I think, 9 issues that you did?
It was. And the idea was going to be, if you look back at that time, there were a group of characters that I introduced in that Solar run that were going to spin off into their own series, which I actually started on. I do indeed have the entire first issue, which was written, penciled, and probably about half inked. And thought it was going to be a lot of fun. I was really looking forward to it. And then as like the day after I got done drawing the very last page, Acclaim called and pulled the plug and said, no, we're not going to put it out.
Is there any chance that that could be resurrected with the new Valiant?
Well, you know, it's funny because actually I won't say I had forgotten about the story and everything, but I didn't even have the artwork or anything like that. And then some of my good friends at IDW came across the finished issue. And so they actually sent me back all the artwork and everything like that here, probably about 2 years ago. So I got to see it again. I don't know, you know, what the future of it could ever be. I'm not sure what the legalities of all those things are necessarily. I just know I did it. I have it back. And it's too bad that it never came out because I had high hopes for it.
I feel like we need another canceled comic cavalcade or something like that where we could get to see something like that
if
come out.
If we can get Quentin and Woody back in print by the original artists, anything's possible.
I actually, you know, it's always a weird thing to have something in your background that you've put together and has never been published. And, you know, like I have way back in the 80s, the early 80s, I did an issue of Justice League that I drew that featured the original 7 Justice League members. And it took place, it was sort of a flashback story, and it took place in the Justice League cave, you know, when they first got together and all that stuff that Illy and Megan wrote. And it's never appeared. It's never been printed, which is kind of a shame. It's weird to look back on it.
Well, speaking of things that never saw the light of day, sorry, because I have a natural spot for here. This is something that I was talking to you about last week, Dan. I think everyone knows the story of Armageddon 2001 and how the ending had to be changed because the ending was leaked. But I didn't know until just last week that issue was drawn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is it? Where is it, Dan?
We should probably fill people in a little bit. And what had happened is, it is the rather famous and some would even say infamous story that we had a crossover called Armageddon 2001 and a villain called Monarch. And at the end of it, Monarch was going to be revealed to be Captain Atom. And what had happened is there used to be a 1-900 service that fans could call up, and I don't know what they paid, like $3, I don't know. And they would get a tape recorded message, and the tape recorded message would basically be updated, say every Tuesday or whatever. And it would say, here are the inside scoops of the comic industry. And they would essentially spill secrets and rumors, and a lot of which turned out not to be true. But in this case, he had gotten the story or the fact that Monarch was going to be revealed to be Captain Atom. And we then had this good, long, healthy debate. The final issue had already been drawn. And we had a good, long debate of, well, do we leave it as Captain Atom because the secret has now been spoiled for a lot of people, or do we switch it? Then the decision was made to change it to Hawk from Hawk and Dove, and that's when we started making the changes. But yeah, originally it was written and drawn as Captain Atom.
So basically what we're saying now is Bleeding Cool is the new 1-900 number of the comics world.
I won't go there.
where are the pages, Dan?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. I may have copies of them someplace, but I don't have the actual physical pages. But if you look back at it, you can see Armageddon 2001 number 2, the second issue, the bookend. You can see that there are not an awful lot of panels with Hawk in it. I mean, it's easy to see how we made the changes that we did.
You know, I never thought I'd say this, but now I want an absolute version of Armageddon. And, yeah. just a compare. Oh.
What one of the reps from DC has told me, if I get a couple of thousand of my closest friends to pre-order, that we can make this happen.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. I always tell people, yeah, you can get anything published you want. You just have to agree to buy 50,000 copies.
No problem, right, Keith?
I might be in for two. I mean, I bought the Booster Gold Futures End book comic 5 times now. That's my cap.
Does that count your digital copy?
I bought it digitally. I bought the 5 years later omnibus that came out. I bought two copies in print, and then I went to Phoenix Comic Con, where Brett Booth and Norm Ratman were tabling, and realized I hadn't brought one with me, so I had to buy it again to get them to autograph. I've done my part.
I bought it three times. So
Canadian instead.
Sorry, what was that, Dan?
I said I would call you a great American, but I have to say great Canadian instead. That's fine.
Well, I did buy one of them in the United States, so you know. It's,
okay.
Used American currency for it.
support your local current economy.
Right.
So, let's see now. You haven't done a lot of work for other companies, primarily DC. Has there just been the fact that you like the way DC works, and or you like the characters, you like the sandbox kind of thing?
Oh, I don't know. I think, first of all, I would say, you know, I wrote Thor for, what, 6-7 years? I mean...
Yeah, for sure. Like 80 plus
75 issues. That's a fairly long time. I did Captain America for a couple of years and drew it for a good chunk of that. Did Spider-Man. So, you know, I think it's sort of like I look at it this way. And the first third of my career was very much at DC. Then there's a second third where I was at Marvel and Acclaim, a couple other places. And then, like, the last third has been back at DC again. And I think a lot of it is when you work, people always ask me, what character do you want to work with or things like that? In many respects, it's more like what people do you want to work with? When you're involved in a creative enterprise, I think it's really important to work with people who you respect, who you like, and whose sensibilities you understand. And I would just say that I think for, gosh, a long, long time, that my relationship with DCE has been mutually beneficial. I think both sides have gained, and it's been a good and happy one.
Completely ignoring your answer about preferring to choose your creative partners over character, a quick internet search says you've created 64 distinct characters.
Really?
Say it's probably a whole lot higher than that. But is there a character that never took off that you created that you really wanted to?
Oh, gosh. first of all,
I'm a huge fan of Thor Girl, so that's where I'm.
Okay. I didn't realize it was that high. Makes sense, though. You know, I think it's more times when you create a character or a concept and just see a lot more roadway than what you're actually allowed to have. And there are probably two things that fit that. One is Agent Liberty, which I would still like to take another crack at someday. I think especially right now, there are a lot of things I could say with the character that would make it very relevant to where we are at as a society today. The other one would be Tangent Comics, if only because when we first came up with Tangent, I really saw that as something that could have long legs, and it just didn't work out that way. And even, you know, Booster Gold, if we want to look at what celebrity culture is right now, in many ways, I think Booster is more appropriate today than ever.
I liked seeing Goldstar turn back up in the Future's End and Convergence, and it did strike me that just with some of the changes in the market, some of the moves for a more diverse cast, that it may be like she may have a better shot right now than Booster does.
Oh sure, I mean when I was first playing around with the 5 year later Booster Gold idea. We hadn't quite gotten to the point where it was going to be 5 years later for sure. And, you know, I kind of knew how that was going to work. But one of my first concepts for Convergence was I wanted to do an issue that was, say, 20 pages long. And each one would be or the issue would be divided up into 3-page segments. And each one would feature a different character from the future coming back in time to be Booster Gold. And he would arrive at different times. So at one point, it was his sister. It was Michelle who came back to be Booster Gold. Another time, for example, he was going to be African-American and shows up like in the year 1974 with the big afro to be sort of the Shaft version of Booster Gold. And I was going to play it that way all the way through. Unfortunately, it wasn't going to work out story-wise, but I thought that would be great fun. I'm still bummed out I didn't get to do that. But, you know, I think I understand what you're saying, and I do think there is a way for Michelle to be a little more in tune with what comics are today, certainly.
If you do a Shaft Booster Gold, I will easily buy 5 copies.
See, and it was going to work out something along those lines, and we would have had a Booster show up, say, in the year 1920, for example, and I wanted to have a Booster show up in the year 1938 where there was another character with a red cape lifting a green car over his head and, you know, just kind of play off comics a little bit. So who knows, maybe one day.
Well, you've had this thread. I mean, Booster is one of the characters he hasn't had a lot of appearances since the New 52, but he kind of keeps popping up in these big events and certainly Convergence is planted in the Future's End book. The Convergence book still leaves one of the great mysteries of the pre-New 52 Booster unsolved. Who is Rip Hunter's mom?
Right. Right. So that was, you know, what happened there is we were always going to reveal the Black Beetle's identity and get into the who is Booster's mom question with Booster Gold number 50. Unfortunately, we never got there. That entire universe came to an end, and there was just no way we could do it, which is entirely too bad. And there again, I've got the answer to that story and those questions, and hopefully one day we'll get a chance to tell that. It would not have been fair or right to do so when we launched the New 52 as part of the Justice League International book. We had to be newer than that.
Now, going back to that, when Justice League International launched, how, at what point did you know that it was, did you switch to full reboot from relaunch? Because certainly there's some things built in Booster Gold and in the Justice League Generation Lost that was going to be part of a relaunch as opposed to starting fresh.
I think that is a question that was something that vexed writers in the New 52 as we relaunched the DCU in general. And some of that is because if you look at it, for all intents and purposes, Green Lantern and Batman really didn't change. Superman changed a lot. And when you have Batman on one end of the spectrum and Superman on the other end of the spectrum, it was always this eternal question of, okay, so this book I'm working on, where does this fit into the overall scheme of things? And even Justice League International, the first issue, for example, was written and drawn with Martian Manhunter in it. And Martian Manhunter was then taken out of the first issue. And we had to alter our plans. And part of it was this eternal conversation we were having really on all 52 titles of what are we, how do we fit, how do we make this work? And I think if you go back and look at some of those books now, you can certainly see what the struggle must have been.
And I think we talked about this on Twitter ages ago, you and I, but for the listeners, Booster still has a Legion flight ring in that Justice League International number one.
Yes.
Was that contentious?
Yes. Well, no, I wouldn't say it was contentious, because if it had been contentious, I'm not the editor. If they really didn't want it to appear that way, they could have taken the ring out, because I think he was wearing it on the cover to JLI number one. So no, it wasn't contentious. It was a topic of discussion, just like everything we were doing was a topic of discussion. And I don't want that to make it sound as though it was bad. To launch 52 new titles like we did at that time, all with a number one, and some with characters and concepts that were really getting big overhauls, was a tremendously difficult and time-consuming proposition. So yeah, it was part of a conversation much more than it was contentious, I'd say.
I often say that there's three things you don't want to see made: laws, sausages, and shared universes.
Yeah, there is truth to that.
Brett, Chris, do you have anything else you want to pop in here? Right, I've got more stuff, obviously, but.
No, I'm waiting for you to go into Booster Land.
I made a couple. I could do a whole episode of Booster. I do have one question that's, Dan, you talked a bit about, the 80s JLI Booster, which was, a very different, take on the character from what you had done in Booster Volume 1. Over the years, what creators have you really liked the take of, aside from yourself on Booster?
Oh, gosh. Well, part of it is there haven't been a whole lot of them. Earlier you mentioned Generation Lost, and I thought everything that happened there was pretty good for the character and true to the character. Certainly artistically, Kevin McGuire, he draws so well, and his characters are so expressive. It was always fun to see what he was doing with Booster. And he was really, I think, the first artist other than me to draw him. It either would have been Kevin or George Perez, one of the two. And I think it was Kevin.
Byrne might have been before that, wouldn't he? The crossover issue with Action, maybe?
could have been, but I thought that was a little deeper in.
Yeah, I don't know.
I thought that was a little deeper in. I think, I'd have to go back and look. I just thought it was a lot of fun to see Kevin do it.
Now, I'm just kind of curious. This is obviously a little bit out of your purview, but is there a reason that a Booster Volume 1 isn't available digitally yet?
I didn't realize it wasn't. So I certainly have no explanation for that, other than perhaps they just haven't gotten to it yet.
Okay. No. I just thought there might be secrets hidden in there that I should go back and look into my physical copies. But
I have found that that what gets released digitally seems to be tied to what comes out in trade paperback, and there isn't a color trade paperback of Volume 1.
Yes, that is true.
There's a showcase, and one of my all-time favorite reprint oddities is in that showcase booster, because there's the issue with Rainbow Raider.
Yes.
That in black and white makes no sense.
Yes. Yeah.
My all-time favorite.
not my finest moment. So
I love the Rainbow Raider story, but it all reaches a climax where Rainbow Raider has two paintings that he has to, like, you know, obviously one's a rip off of the other, but it's all based on color, and the entire finale of it's based on they were colored.
One of the things I have often said is that my first writing gig at DC was writing Sun Devils, which I had co-created with Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas. Jerry started writing it. He had to step aside, and I wrote like the last five issues. But what Booster Gold, you can see, I mean, it does demonstrate the idea of, if you want to read a comic where you are watching someone learn on the job and make more than his share of mistakes, you can certainly find it in those 25 issues.
So what's the big difference between working for DC in the first third of your life or of your career and this third of your career?
I don't know that, there are a lot of names and faces that have changed, obviously. The universe itself has changed. But I think one of the things I'm certainly aware of now is when I was there the first time, especially the first couple of years, you always feel like you have to prove yourself to everyone. And, I was acutely aware of working with guys like Dick Giordano and Joe Orlando and Ross Andrew, who was my editor on Warlord at first, who were incredible artists in their own right. And I always felt that, I had something to prove. And I think now it's more like I feel that I have demonstrated that I have the chops and therefore still have a place. So, the difference is, you walk in, you've got at some point five comics total in your credits, and then all of a sudden a chunk of years go by and you have 500 or so. I don't know.
I'm sorry to go back to this, but Sun Devils, once again, one of those little series that I loved back in the day. Was there any discussion of naming the characters, which are named in the series 1, 2, 3, red, green, blue? That would have made more sense to me because they all had a distinct color to them, yet they're called 1, 2, 3. Was that a conscious choice? Do you know?
At that time, we got a little caught up in a couple of different things. And originally, the series itself was called Starbirds. And it really was sort of like Blackhawks in space. And Starbirds was the original name. And ultimately, like at the last minute, that did not pass muster with copyright and trademark. So we switched it to Sun Devils. The three guys, I kept referring to them as Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And that's really what I wanted to call them. And for obvious reasons, we couldn't quite do that either.
All comes down to the lawyer. I did have another question from around that time. When you started on Superman in about 89, you were coming in about a half dozen months after what is still one of the most controversial Superman in continuity stories that ever happened. the Supergirl saga. So what was it like to, at the time was, I mean, there was no internet at the time. What was actually the reaction that you saw when you came in of, you know, Superman had executed three Kryptonians, and then you and Jerry Ordway and Roger Stern had to kind of keep going from that point?
Right. Yeah, it was hugely controversial. And I think had the internet existed at that time, it would have been that, you know, times three. I always thought, for the most part, that if Superman was ever going to be put in that position, that it had to be a more immediate threat. It didn't bother me so much that Superman killed the Kryptonians as much as it was him just being a stone-cold executioner. You know, and if you think of that cover, there's a green cover, and I can't remember if it was, I think it was Superman itself, where he's actually wearing the hood like an executioner would wear. That was, to me, the problem. That if you wanted to have Superman kill the Kryptonians, I think it had to be a situation where innocent life was in immediate peril. And the only way to stop them from taking innocent life was to kill them. At that point, Superman still makes the same decision, but he's much more Superman as part of that. And the funny thing is, everybody gets kind of, you know, twisted in knots over that scene in the movie. Yet that's what Superman did. When he kills Zod in the movie, it is because there are human beings right there who were in you know, immediate danger. And the problem with the comic book was, I always thought, not that Superman did it as much as it was the way he did it, because he was judge, jury, and executioner right there. And it was, you know, it was a police officer walking right up to an individual who had dropped his gun, dropped his knife, said, "I surrender," waved the right flag, and still blew his head off. I mean, that's basically what it was.
And it, but at no point did you, you know, try to retcon that away or bring them back or anything like that?
No, that would have been, I think that would have been unfair to the readers. And frankly, it would have been unfair to John, and it would have been unfair to the character as well, that once you have that take place, and, you know, it's important to remember, at that time, Superman was experiencing a new height in popularity. More people were reading the book. More people were on board with it. And there were people who liked that story. And it's, you know, wouldn't have been for me to go retcon that. I wouldn't have felt right doing that. I wouldn't have written it the way it was done, but that doesn't mean I thought it was something that should be done away with.
Well, and certainly you, like you especially, and Jerry Ordway mined that a lot for quite a long time. I mean, the Exile story was then, you know, almost a year of storyline after that.
Yeah, and I think that was the part that made it work, is Superman basically atoned for his sins. And he, the story became the device that was used for him to say, "I will never kill again." So I think you take that story and then turn it into a greater asset for the character. And in a way, it was making, you know, lemonade out of the lemons. And I think it's a story that still serves the character well for what he ended up becoming. And primarily it was, you know, Mike Carlin as editor and Jerry and Roger Stern that took lead on that. They had already started to work in that direction when I came on board. And, you know, I certainly agreed with where they were going with it.
I have one last Superman question. Does Superman wear his underwear on the outside?
It's not underwear. It's all part of the same costume. And, you know, if you're wearing a plaid shirt, no one goes up to you and says, and ask if all those stripes are on the outside or the inside of the shirt. It's all part of the same fabric. And that's how the so-called underwear work, just like the logo, the S shield, is sewn into the costume as well.
That seems like a question you've been asked something similar before.
I was actually delighted that I finally got it into print on the Brewster Gold Convergence issues.
I love that. I love that bit in the Brewster Gold. That killed me. No, because
I have expected that to end up on the cutting room floor somewhere, but it didn't. They left it in.
Brett, Chris, do you have anything you want to pop in with?
I think I want to hit, you were talking about controversial, and so I want to hit controversial in Marvel. And the Spider-Man clone saga and Sensational Spider-Man. I just went back and reread some of that. And so I just want to, again, were you supposed to have a longer run on that? And also, what kind of, I guess, backlash was there? Because it wasn't a terribly popular storyline with the fans. And so were you trying to kind of bring it back and fix it? Or were you just kind of going with the plan?
That's a lot of questions that end up with some long answers in a way. I was supposed to be around longer. There's no doubt about it. And I wish I could have been. When they asked me to come on board, the idea was that they wanted to be able to do good, fun Spider-Man stories again. And I think they saw it as a problem that Peter Parker was married to Mary Jane. It made him seem older. In a way, they always wanted him to have this aspect of tragedy in his life, and instead he was married to a supermodel. And I think Marvel was always looking for some way to get out from under that rock. And they found a different way to do it years later, but even then, that was something they were interested in, and that's where Ben Reilly came into the equation. And the idea was that they wanted to do fun, sort of classic in tone, Spider-Man stories with Ben Reilly. And Peter Parker was going to go away. And I said, so you're telling me you're going to have one Spider-Man, not two. It's going to be Ben Reilly. Yep, we are, we are totally in on it. And, I said, okay, that's fine. And because those are the kind of stories I wanted to tell. And as I got into it, I enjoyed working with the other writers like Howard Mackey and Tom DeFalco. We got along great. But every time we decided to do something to try and advance that particular cause somehow, changes would get made. And a decision that was made on Monday would get reversed on Tuesday and go 180 degrees in the opposite direction on Wednesday. And there was no way it felt like to get a really good story coming out of it. And finally, then I said, look, if you guys don't want to commit to Ben Reilly, that's fine. I'm totally with you. But let's make that decision now and get out of this, because this thing is turning into a disaster. And we talked about different ways of doing it. I know at one point I put together a fairly long memo that explained, okay, here's how we get out of it. And there again, we just were never able to do it because for whatever reason, when a decision was made, we couldn't stick with it. And finally, I just got so frustrated. I said, this isn't the place for me. I'm not happy with you. You're not happy with me. Let's go our own separate ways. And that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, because it always struck me, I guess it looked to me like you were kind of hired to pull off a lot of the Superman concept, like the weekly book and to really raise Spider-Man to be the premier character in Marvel. And I mean, he is in his own way, but it definitely looked like an attempt to be Superman for Marvel.
Yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't phrase it quite that way, Brett. What I would say is they really wanted to say, find a way to your right, to sort of re-elevate Spider-Man again. Not that Spider-Man was really hurting sales-wise, but to find a way to give it, I think, momentum is maybe the right word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were trying to do that, but certainly if you look at Sensational Spider-Man number 0, I totally sold out on trying to make Ben Reilly the Peter Parker-type Spider-Man character. It really was me saying, okay, You guys want to go with Ben Reilly as the new Spider-Man long term? Let's go for it. Let's all get on board and go for it. And it's sort of like, you know, you're in the trenches and the colonel yells, okay, we're going to go take Hill 183. You know, everybody fix your bayonets. Let's go. And you charge up out of that trench and you're 10 steps down into the field of fire and you turn around and you realize everyone else is still in the trench. And that's kind of how I felt.
You know what was missing, Dan? Two words, triangle numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
I got to say, the triangle numbers, I think, are one of the all-time greatest, simplest ideas in comics. You know, everyone would ask us, what order we read these in? And back then, you know, we had on the Superman books a much higher percentage of sales on the newsstand. And there especially people got confused. And then putting on those triangle numbers, the response we got to that was absolutely incredible. It was such a simple idea. It was absolutely awesome. It would be like someone saying, hey, you know what? If you put a pill of just drop a aspirin tablet in your gas tank, you'll all get 3,000 miles a gallon. It's like, sure, let's do it. How come no one thought of this before?
I'm a little surprised that people haven't really used it that much since.
I am too.
I have my fingers crossed that it would turn up on the convergence issues, but
yeah, there probably just really wasn't a need for it there. But I think, honest to God, I think one of the reasons it doesn't get used now is everyone says automatically, oh no, everyone will think of us that way. We'll get compared to them and blah, 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 all that other stuff. When in fact, to me, it was no look, you buy a book, right? And what does it have on the bottom of every page? A page number, so you know where you're at. I think it's a good logical idea.
Well, that if we're going to end on a logical idea.
Triangle numbers, huh?
We have had Jerry Conway on the show before. Someday we will get you and Jerry on and have a Sun Devils retrospective episode.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yes.
That'd be great. I tell Jerry that I owe my writing career to him because he was the first guy to trust me at a keyboard.
That's fantastic. Okay, we're going to wrap up. I will invite you back another time, Dan. I'm sure whatever secret project you're working on, we'll want to talk about that. And
yes, we'll.
And September. I'm assuming. Go ahead.
I was going to say yes, you will, and I guarantee that you will.
All right then.
Yeah. Why don't we just set the date right now? Like, let's just...
Oh God, when does this list come out? I want to know what this is.
Yeah,
the day after the book is solicited, you're back.
There you go.
That's right. It's Sun Devil.
Sun Devils with the Rainbow Raider is what I want to see right there.
There you go. Sun Devils Reborn.
Featuring one of the many Robins. All right. Well, we'll give you a sec. We'll give you a chance at the end to plug your stuff. Brett, say goodbye.
Goodbye. I'm Brett. Still.
I'm Brett.
Chris, say
goodbye. This is Chris saying, "Great Caesar's ghost on a pogo stick." That was fun.
I wonder how many people got that.
Oh, come on. Oh, nobody knows what a pogo stick is or a Great Caesar's ghost for them.
You should see the stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor.
Yes, I would love to.
All right, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes, wetalkpodcasts.com, also on comicosity.com, also on... is it Stitcher we're on now, Brett?
We are on Stitcher, yes. And a couple of others, yeah. There's lots of ways to find our show.
Comic Podcast Network, I believe. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And I want to say before I let you have the last word, Dan, is thank you for Booster Gold. It is great in I can't imagine telling teenage me that that I'm going to spend an hour talking to Dan Juergens and get to say just thanks for a character that I've loved for all of these years.
Very nice of you, Keith. Thank you.
All right. So Batmite, Batman Beyond, Secret Project. Anything else that you want to plug?
No, I think that's good for now. I think Batman Beyond, I really think we're building a very interesting, fun, and intriguing future for the DC Universe with a lot of different elements, be it from the DCU proper or the Batman Beyond animated world, putting it all together for some fun stuff. And if you're looking for something that is just different, kind of off the wall, just a good, fun read with a sense of charm and energy to it, Batmite is for you. So, yeah, check it out, by all means.
And anytime you want to throw those pages into a scanner, we're happy to host the unseen Armageddon 2001 number two.
You've got me thinking. I'm going to have to go look for that stuff again. It's been a long time.
Really, anything, you know, the specials as well, you know, all that stuff. Totally willing to have a look at it.
Sure. Sounds good.
Thanks so much, Dan.
My pleasure. Really appreciate it. Thank you, gentlemen.